Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. And who better to take stock of the intelligence that we need to bring to bear at this moment than a career intelligence professional, my friend and colleague at the Center for Security Policy, its president and CEO, who is indeed a career intelligence professional, Fred Flights, service in the Central Intelligence Agency, on the House Intelligence Committee, and of course in the State Department and the National Security Council under John Bolton, as it happens. Fred Flights, it's so good to have you back. Welcome. I wanted to talk with you a bit, Fred, about something that happened before you joined the NSC, but that clearly cast a shadow over your time there and over this presidency from basically its inception onwards, namely the prosecution, well, I would call it persecution, of General Michael Flynn. There was a very, very extraordinary development the other day, and one that I know you've been giving some considerable thought to and discussing with other media outlets. I'd appreciate you giving us an update on the Flynn case and what we should now make of it.
Frank, it's great to be here, and this is an important issue we have to talk about. This is really not being discussed adequately in the mainstream media. Last week, a D.C. appeals court ordered District Judge Sullivan to dismiss Michael Flynn's case. But the reasoning is so important. One of the judges, Judge Rao, wrote, "Each of our co-equal branches should be encouraged to self-correct when it errs. If evidence comes to light calling into question the integrity or purpose of an underlying criminal investigation, the executive branch must have the authority to decide that further prosecution is not in the interest of justice. Now, let's think about this, Frank. We know that the FBI agents who came in to interview Flynn, the White House, it said in the notes they were planning on entrapping him, putting him in a perjury trap. We know that FBI Director Comey went to the White House without telling White House counsel he was coming. We know steps were taken to encourage Flynn not to have an attorney present. We know that intelligence was leaked to damage Flynn, to make it harder for him not to be released. So we're talking here about more than simply something that calls in question the integrity or purpose of an underlying criminal investigation. This was a massive government conspiracy to destroy a good man, to abuse our justice system, the FBI and our intelligence agencies. It is such an appalling abuse of government power. And I was so pleased when finally some element of our government did the right thing and said that this incredibly fraudulent case needed to be thrown out. Now, the media is not going to admit what happened, but to say that this was a miscarriage of judgment, I think we can both say, is a gross understatement.
Yes, indeed. And to the great credit of attorney Sidney Powell, who is representing Michael Flynn in all of this, this turnabout, the writ of mandamus being approved by the appeals court, a fairly unusual action, forcing, we hope, the federal district judge, Emmett Sullivan, to reverse course. I guess that's still unclear, Fred, how he's going to proceed. But the point here is there was indeed gross misconduct on the part of Peter Strzok and others in the Obama administration. I want to ask you about something, though, Fred, which you may have insights into in various incarnations you've had over the years. This seems to have been about more than just trying to take out Donald Trump, the obvious ideological campaign against him that is now, I think, unmistakable. There seems to me to be also a considerable amount of animus behind all this. Maybe you would even call it a vendetta against Michael Flynn in his own right. What do we know about why the Obama team was so determined to destroy Michael Flynn that wasn't obvious heretofore?
That's a good question, and I've been giving some thought to that. It's pretty clear that the Obama team and the Democratic Party did not want someone so knowledgeable about abuses of intelligence and government power as the National Security Advisor, someone who they also knew would fight against him, because he'd already been doing that. I might note that he was strongly against the nuclear deal with Iran. He was calling for massive reform of the U.S. intelligence community and maybe doing away with the Director of National Intelligence. This was the last thing that the security establishment wanted to hear. He was a very significant threat to the foreign policy and national security establishment. And I think that's why they went after him. And you remember the very strong stand he took against jihadists and radical Islam. I mean, this was someone who, for the establishment, was determined to keep out of government. And that's why he had such a big target on his back.
I think that's so important, Fred, and I really appreciate you putting it as plainly as you did. So it wasn't just going after him as a proxy or as a vehicle to get at Donald Trump. It wasn't just fear that a guy who knew as much about the intelligence business as Mike Flynn did would ferret out, in all likelihood, what John Brennan and what James Comey and what Jim Clapper had done to abuse their powers in the intelligence business. But they also, and I gather this was not just, you know, the minions. This was at the level of Barack Obama himself. They hated this guy for his various, as you say, well, apostasies on Iran, on the conduct of, you know, the president in Benghazi, I think, and more generally against the Islamists. So these are the sorts of things that the vast majority of Americans who've watched this drama play out, probably somewhat mystified about what was going on, really need to understand about this vendetta, about this determination to destroy not just a good man and a patriot and a military hero, but a guy who was a real threat to their whole enterprise.
When I was on the House Intelligence Committee staff in the 2000s, Frank, the Defense Intelligence Agency, which General Flynn headed, was usually the lone dissenter on community assessments. One of them was on North Korea, where the North Korea was enriching uranium. And the community wanted to throw this out because it went against the Democratic narrative that the WMD programs are not really a problem. Well, DIA was right. And it was right because it was directed by Michael Flynn, who encouraged his analysts to call him like they see him and not to simply go along with the pack, to not make analysis by consensus, by committee. Well, we need people like that in government to head these intelligence agencies to get the president the truth. And if there's divergence of opinion, the president needs to hear all of them.
And this is so important, Fred, against the backdrop of some of the terrific work you've done over the years in exposing that cherry picking that John Brennan did to try to make the case that the intelligence community had found the Russians were involved in this election and they wanted Donald Trump to be, you know, victorious. This was untrue, and it's all the more reason why a guy who was prepared to stand athwart such malevolent and malfeasant behavior was such a problem as Mike Flynn was. Fred, thank you for your time today explaining all this. It's so appreciated, as is your work at the Center for Security Policy. I know you'll keep it up. We'll look forward to talking with you again next week. Next up, we will speak with Chris Farrell of Judicial Watch about what on earth is going on in a revolution in America. Right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back, and it is a pleasure to say we have with us a very special guest. He is the guy who really is in charge of the investigative activities of one of the most important investigative entities in our country. And I'm not talking about the Federal Bureau of Investigations or anything in the government. I'm talking about one of the most powerful institutions outside of government in Washington, D.C., and that is, of course, Judicial Watch. His name is Chris Farrell. He has been with Judicial Watch for quite some time and is an extraordinary resource, as is his organization, perhaps in part because of what he brings to the job as the Director of Research and Investigation at Judicial Watch, namely a background in counterintelligence. that as a result of his service to our military in the United States Army. He is a graduate of, indeed, of its military intelligence officers basic and advanced courses. And I see a lot of those skills being brought to bear in his day-to-day work these days. Chris Farrell, it is so good to have you with us. Welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. It's been too long. I wanted to call attention particularly, Chris, to an extraordinarily important piece that you wrote the other day in the Daily Caller under the title, The Left is Clearing a Pathway to Power. Now, as you know, we do what I call intelligence briefings here daily at Secure Freedom Radio, and we talk a lot about this, but I want you to just sort of walk our audience through what, on the basis of a trained counterintelligence officer, you're seeing in place now and being brought to bear against our republic in the form of these various groups that are operating in cities across this country, in some cases, you know, destroying parts of them, in other cases, occupying parts of them. Who are these people and what is motivating them, Chris?
Well, they're Marxists, if you want, you know, a one-word answer. And they are engaged in subversion. There's a low-level insurrection underway, and it is a model of insurrection, again, with these Marxist roots that is really sort of the action arm of what an Italian Marxist by the name of Antonio Gramsci had theorized and talked about. With this sort of, you know, the long march through the institutions, the sort of eroding of all the principles or pillars of Western civilization in an attempt to capture language, to persuade the public, to erode confidence in the government and the Constitution. And you see increasingly hysterical words and deeds and really craziness. I mean, that's just the vernacular expression of it, in an attempt to intimidate the public and to give a perception out there that everything is coming apart at the seams.
There are pieces of that I want to drill down on. It seems as though they're, of course, not just trying to intimidate the public. These folks are, well, palpably and successfully intimidating our political elites and leadership. And Chris, if what we're up against really is not just a low-level insurrection, as you put it, bad as that would be, but the first stages of really revolutionary activity, you know, no longer sort of covertly marching through the institutions and converting them or subverting them or otherwise dominating them for the ultimate purpose of revolution, but actually moving into the overt revolutionary phase, maybe in a small way at the moment. But if that's the case, the absence of pushback from these intimidated elites and our institutions, for that matter, you know, our law enforcement personnel and our FBI and so on, is a very ominous and almost, I'm sure, emboldening thing for those who are perpetrating such crimes, aren't they?
Yeah, I mean, a parallel would be parents who, in a misguided way, ignore the outrageous conduct of their children, saying, oh, it's just a phase, they'll get over it, or Johnny will eventually calm down, or he'll get his act together. Well, you know, at a certain point, Johnny doesn't get his act together and doesn't calm down, and, you know, Johnny ends up doing something horrific.
Or Johnny may even take away from it that it's okay for him to be acting out, right? I mean, if you follow that analogy all the way through, what we're really doing is kind of signaling a tolerance for it. And that can only be emboldening to these characters, can it?
More than tolerance. It's enabling. I don't want to get too psychological on all this, but that's really part of what happens. And then the normal sort of guardrails on conduct, they get knocked down. Now the police are suddenly the problem. So you have a handful of bad actors or questionable circumstances about, you know, levels of violence and levels of force used and the apprehension of people engaged in criminal activity. And all of a sudden, the world gets flipped upside down. And now we're going to argue from the specific to the general.
So because police officer A did something wrong, now we have to dismantle entire police departments because one person did something incorrectly or unlawful or whatever.
In a different state or municipality, for heaven's sakes.
Right. And so, and arguing from the specific to the general is always wildly dangerous. and acting on that and making broad sweeping, when Congress is writing national legislation because a guy used a chokehold in Minneapolis, hold on a second. There's tons of law enforcement agencies with good guys and good gals doing all kinds of good stuff, and now we're gonna dismantle law enforcement because of the conduct of, even if you say it's a 1% or even 5% of law enforcement officers are using excessive force, that doesn't mean you destroy all of the police departments in the country because there's a handful of guys who are dirtballs. You just don't. No one operates that way. No one does.
Let me just ask you about something, and I don't mean to hoist you on your own petard here, but we have talked on this program before, Chris, about really serious problems with the FBI. And if anything, I think their absence from this scene, apart from, of course, looking massively into that noose hoax with NASCAR, which apparently, according to Tucker Carlson, required 15 different agents to get to the bottom of the fact that it was a hoax. But apart from that, they have been seemingly almost entirely absent from this. And some of the previous problems with it at the leadership level, to be clear, have prompted you to say, hey, we need to start over on the FBI. I think you've recommended using the Marshall Service as a new incubator for the kind of capabilities we need. So this isn't defunding the police, to be sure. And you're not talking about, doing this willy-nilly, but talk us through, Chris, why it's important to be restructuring in that case, even as we're resisting, I hope, these sweeping, ideas of change that the revolutionaries have in mind for the police establishments more generally.
Sure. Well, there's two things in play. One is the scope of authority of an organization like the FBI versus a city police department or a county sheriff's office, two wildly different scopes of authority. And then number two is established historical documented track record. And so in respect to the FBI, of course, they have enormous latitude and authority as a federal law enforcement agency and an intelligence agency both.
Which has been abused systemically for years now under the previous administration. Yeah.
Yeah, grossly. And then the flip side of that, the polar opposite is, a police department in a municipality or a county sheriff's office that does not have nearly the authority or scope of a federal law enforcement and intelligence service. And nor do they have the same size force or financing or anything else. So they're two very, very different examples. Are they law enforcement? Sure, the way in which they operate, they're organized and they're funded are just wildly different.
So let me turn to a last question for you, Chris, because again, I want to tap into your expertise as a counterintelligence professional. Do you see signs that foreign elements are involved in this revolutionary activity that's bursting forth on our streets at the moment?
I don't know why they wouldn't be. I mean, this is prime hunting ground for them. I mean, this is a dream come true. I mean, there are any number of, foreign intelligence services who would love to get in the middle of this. And they can do it any number of ways. They can certainly do it in sort of an overt official way, but much more intriguingly and a lower risk to them is to certainly have folks that they've recruited, and they can be everything from sort of card-carrying members to, the fellow travelers, cooperators types. And why wouldn't they want to get in the middle of it? This is deeply subversive. It destabilizes the country. It creates enormous mischief. It allows a political and a social leverage point for them. It contributes to their ability to conduct influence operations against us. It is a dream come true for any number of foreign intelligence services to get in the middle of this and just either have people with eyes and ears collecting and listening and watching, or overtly agitating. So this is a it's a real threat.
Yeah, at a minimum, distracting us big time from what they're doing in, for example, the Chinese Communist Party's case, Hong Kong, and perhaps next Taiwan and elsewhere. And in addition to this, Chris, and we'll have to leave it at this, our colleague Trevor Loudon has been pointing out that there are at least two prominent Chinese Communist Party tied front organizations, Freedom Road Socialist Organization and Liberation Road, that have been intimately involved in, you know, bringing about and promoting the work, for example, of Black Lives Matter. So could those connections be, in fact, operating? We need to look into this much more intensively. I hope that's one of the things you'll be doing at Judicial Watch. Chris Farrell, we appreciate you and your work tremendously. Come back to us with updates, if you would, very soon. Next up, we'll talk with Kevin Freeman about the latest developments on the economic warfare front with China and more. Straight ahead.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back, and we are joined by Kevin Freeman, whose expertise we blessedly take advantage of each week here at Secure Freedom Radio. He is also an incredibly important source of information and insights for us as a senior fellow of the Center for Security Policy and a member of the Committee on the Present Danger, China. Now, that's all in addition to his day jobs, which are, among other things, running the Economic War Room program, known as Economic War Room with Kevin Freeman of Blaze TV, and blogging, tremendously importantly, at globaleconomicwarfare.com, and as the founder and driving force behind an incredibly important initiative, which we'll be talking a bit more about, the National Security Investment Consultants Institute. Kevin Freeman, gosh, that's a mouthful, and what a heavy load you're lifting, but doing manfully and doing well and to benefit of our country, thankfully. So welcome back, sir. Good to have you with us as always. I want to talk to you about two things today, Kevin, if I can. First, the people of Hong Kong have now had, enacted by the Chinese Communist Party in Beijing, a law that they haven't actually been allowed to read yet, but that is going to have a profound and perhaps deadly impact on their lives. This is taking place, Kevin, against the backdrop of something that our Committee on the Present Danger, China, has been very engaged on for the past week or so with your help, namely the fact that we've got 20 plus, at least 20, and some evidence from the Pentagon considerably more, Chinese People's Liberation Army companies operating in the United States. I want to talk to you about what that means from an economic warfare and national security perspective in the first instance, and what we ought to be doing about it that could be kind of a twofer, both with respect to the national security and with respect to Hong Kong.
Sure. Well, Frank, it's almost insane that over 20 years ago, the Chinese Communist Party and the People's Liberation Army decided that they'd take a new tack. They would pretend like they were Western friendly, and they would infiltrate our stock markets, our educational institutions, our Hollywood and media outlets, and they would run their continuing anti-human communist agenda, and they've done it full tilt. And only recently, you know, you and I have been talking about this for at least a dozen years, but only recently have we began to realize just how deeply embedded in American society they've become, and they've done so because they've made it about the money. They've essentially offered opportunity, i.e. bribes, to officials, not including people such as the vice president's son, Hunter Biden, and others who have been offered lucrative chances to make lots of money. And they've, as a result, embedded these companies that, I guess it was 1999 that the law required that they be noted and outed, and yet they have been touted and promoted.
We've not, I think, properly understood what it means, for example, to have these companies in our capital markets. But Kevin, for example, this preeminent Chinese communist military company known as AVIC, or the Aviation Industry Corporation of China, has been subjected to a little scrutiny by our colleague Roger Robinson and determined to have been involved not only in our capital markets, namely tapping those for hard currency, which presumably is then being used to underwrite the buildup of missiles and aircraft and drones and other airborne weapon systems for the Chinese People's Liberation Army to use against us. But in addition to that, they've also been involved, apparently, in a number of joint ventures in this country. One of them, a fellow by the name of Jonathan Ward, told Maria Bartiromo recently, involves a partnership with General Electric. They've also been involved, apparently, in a bunch of mergers and acquisitions of American companies, which has implications for their access to, you know, our technology or our intellectual property. Kevin Freeman, again, in the hands of a regime like the Chinese Communist Party, isn't that a real threat to both our economic interests as well as our national security ones?
Well, when you put it all together, I mean, it sums up what we say all the time. What we see as a marketplace, our enemies view as a battle space. Essentially, what they're doing is they're getting us to fund them and taking our technology to develop weapons that they intend to use against us. It's insane that we would participate in this, but we've made a little profit all along the way. That's the point. They see us, we see it as a marketplace, they see it as a battle space. They've taken our technology, advanced it with our money, and pointed it at us.
And this point of getting some money out of them, I think it's fair to say that the people who are getting the money are principally the guys brokering the deals, not so much the investors in the case of Wall Street, or probably these joint ventures either, for that matter. And the real costs are largely obscured, aren't they? Because the amount of intellectual property that's being ripped off, for example, is going to be somewhat nebulous to many of the people other than those most immediately involved, presumably. But Kevin, let me just turn to this question of if the president chooses to do so, under the same law that required these companies to be outed, as you put it, he has the authority to shut down these companies, to stop their access to our capital markets and so on. Should he not be doing that, as, well, we put it in a letter to the president from the Committee on the Present Danger, which you signed, thankfully, over the weekend, shouldn't he be doing that, not just for our own interests in this country, but also as a measure of our determination to demonstrate solidarity with the people of Hong Kong and to really punish the Chinese Communist Party for what they're doing there?
By all means. It should have been done yesterday, 5 years ago, 10 years ago, 20 years ago. But by all means, Mr. President, this is the time. We can't go any further. The Chinese have shown their hand with the way that they've treated the release of COVID-19, the Chinese CCP coronavirus. They've shown that they are unwilling to protect the world, that they will protect their interests at any cost. They've shown that they are an enemy to their own people, whether it's the Uyghurs or whether it's the family that wants to have three children and not two children, or whether it's the body that's being organ harvested, or the religion they're persecuting, or their own people that they're using social credit scores on. By all means, they have been proven to be a rogue regime, and they're about to do it to the free people of Hong Kong against their word, against their promises. So by all means, Mr. President, send a strong message and at the same time, protect the American people. Absolutely. I signed the letter and 100% agree with it.
Amen. Well, Kevin, thank you for doing it. And again, thank you for the work that you've done in the past year or two at Economic War Room for really showcasing so much of what you just touched on there and doing it so well. Let me turn to another issue that you've done brilliantly on over the years, Kevin, and that is mining and helping the rest of us have some appreciation of the significance of a document called Unrestricted Warfare, which was written originally by two Chinese People's Liberation Army colonels. Tell us about the battle plan, one of your famous expressions, the battle plan that it represents, and particularly its relevance to our stock market and what we best be doing to prevent some unrestricted warfare in that battle space against us by the Chinese.
Well, Frank, as we were going through the stock market crash in 2008, and I was researching, you know, who was behind it, what was going on, was it natural, were people intending bad things from it, and I noticed that it impacted the election. It changed who was president. I mean, on September 11th, you can look it up, Google it, Gallup poll, John McCain, 2011, He was leading Barack Obama, some say by 5 points, some say by more than that, and he'd had a steady and consistent lead. And on September 11th, Lehman Brothers began to fail, and the stock market collapsed. And from that moment on, Barack Obama was, whether the vote had taken place or not, he was president of the United States. It was inevitable because the market crashed. There's a good report out here that says why stocks can predict the next president that FAMag.com, which is Financial Association magazine, put out. It's a fact. And when I opened up the book, Unrestricted Warfare, in 2008 and turned to a page that said a single man-made stock market crash is a new concept weapon, and it was in the context of financial terrorism and George Soros and the context of hacking and all of the things that the Chinese People's Liberation Army had intended for us, and I realized we're in an economic war with China, and one of their top weapons is to crash the stock market, and they could do it with high-frequency trading algorithm hacking that 99% of Americans don't understand. All of a sudden, you just wake up and the Dow is down 1,000 points or 2,000 points or 3,000 points, and you say, I don't know what's going on. Oh, well, it's COVID. Oh, well, it's the trade war. Oh, well, it's Black Lives Matter. Oh, well, it's all these things. And they could do it without us even noticing, and they could determine who the president of the United States was. I realized it in 2008 that they had that potential, and they absolutely have it. They've increased their ability and capability of it now, and we've got to do something to protect our country.
And what would that be?
Well, I recommend the institution of the uptick rule. It's something that was in place from 1937 to 2007. It worked very effectively, preventing major, massive market crashes. It was put in place by Joe Kennedy. They took it out in 2007. The next year, we had the Great Recession, and we had this huge stock market decline that had nefarious action in it. It basically says that you can't just sell short, which is a means of making money from the market going down, unless you can't just continually sell short unless somebody in the intervening time steps up and puts a buy order in and buys something. It's called an uptick because the stock goes up one tick. When they buy it, it goes up a tick, and then you can resume short selling it. It's a very simple thing. We could put it in place now. I know high frequency trading is complicated, but there are means of which to enforce the uptick rule with that, and that combined with a limitation on naked short selling, which is a complex thing. But when you put those two things in place, and it's recommended by people like Jim Cramer, Charles Schwab, Leon Cooperman, big hedge fund guy, famous names on Wall Street, they say it's simple. Let's put it back. Unfortunately, people make money from high frequency trading. They don't want anything to slow them down or interrupt them, and as a result, they put our country at risk. And the SEC can solve this by putting back the uptick rule.
Amen. Kevin Freeman, thank you for your time today, my friend. It's great to talk with you. We'll look forward to doing so again in the very near future. Next up, we'll speak with Rosemary Jenks. We'll talk with her about the president's important immigration pause, what it might mean for you. That and more, straight ahead.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. And it is a special pleasure to say welcome to a dear friend and very valued colleague. In fact, I think one of the people I admire most in Washington, D.C. We were talking earlier in the program with another, Chris Farrell, but Rosemary Jenks is right up there in the pantheon of people and, well, and the organization she works for, the institutions that I think is most estimable and needed in Washington, D.C. at the moment. In Rosemary Jenks' case, she is the Director of Government Relations at a fabulously influential, impactful, important group called Numbers USA. You can find out much more about it, including some extraordinarily informative and well-done videos at numbersusa.com. She's a graduate of the Harvard Law School, and despite that, she's a very good egg. Rosemary Jenks, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. It's great to have you with us. Listen, Rosemary, there's a lot to talk about here. Your area of expertise is, of course, immigration in the broadest sense. There was a signal development out of the Trump White House this past week, and I want you to talk a little bit about both what was the nature of the decision and what it says about the importance that this president attaches to holding the line on immigration at this particular moment, especially?
Well, this is it really is unprecedented, this linking of immigration to the unemployment crisis we're having right now. It should be common sense, but it has never been done before. And, you know, this goes back to April 22nd. Just before April 22nd, the president tweeted that he was going to pause all immigration. And apparently some of the folks around him in the White House didn't know that was coming and immediately set about reining that back. So what ended up happening with the April 22nd executive order is that he only barred certain categories of green card holders. So extended family, the chain migration, and most employment-based, although not the investor visa, which is 80% Chinese nationals coming in and starting companies in the United States. So it was limited to that. And then there was a provision that asked DHS and the Labor Department to do a review within 30 days to recommend additional guest worker programs to be paused. So 30 days later, we got this new executive order that is, it continues with the pause on the green cards, and then it expanded the pause to include several, not all, but several of the guest worker programs like H-1Bs, H-2Bs, L-1s, and J-1s. And it is absolutely a bold move by the president. And, you know, I think this shows that his instincts are right on the immigration issue. Unfortunately, he's got too many people around him who are kind of the globalist, big business, chamber of commerce types, who are, as we speak, you know, talking about ways to roll this back. But, you know, when you've got 47 plus million Americans filing unemployment claims, it is impossible to justify bringing in foreign workers. It just doesn't make sense. And he recognized that.
The exception to that statement, of course, is you can justify it if you are one of these globalist business leaders trying to figure out ways to pay workers less than you would have to pay some of those unemployed Americans to work for you. And this is part of what you've focused so brilliantly on at Numbers USA, that this cynical disregard for the best interest of our own people and our nation, for that matter, is unfortunately just one example of how the Chamber of Commerce and, you know, some of its members, for sure, have been really indifferent, I think, to the larger common weal of the United States, have they not?
They have. And, you know, it's interesting, particularly right now when race is such a big topic of conversation around the country. These groups that are advocating for more foreign workers, more cheap labor, what they are missing, you know, they're virtue signaling on Black Lives Matter and all this, putting out statements of corporate blah, blah, blah donations. But what they're ignoring purposefully is that immigration, mass immigration, has the most negative impact on Black Americans and on other minorities in this country. Mostly Black and Hispanics.
And that's because these immigrants are going to take jobs away from those populations first and foremost. Is that right?
Well, but in addition to that, I mean, they're like, the H-2B brings in construction workers and landscapers and, you know, jobs that minority Americans will actually take if given the opportunity and the pay. But also, even the H-1B visa, which is high-skilled, mostly tech workers, that is being used by employers so that they don't have to recruit African-Americans. We have far more African-American STEM graduates than are represented in tech companies because employers don't have to recruit them. They can just bring in H-1Bs.
And some of those may be, obviously, for various ethnic minorities as well. But you're saying that it would certainly be to the detriment of American minorities in this country. Rosemary, let me hit you with two other things quickly, because we're going to run out of time before we run out of things to talk with you about, needless to say. One is, you mentioned Chinese green card holders a moment ago, that they're being paused, which is a good thing. But I'm just struck by this as another example of the seeming indifference of our country to the fact that Chinese nationals are, A, obliged under the national intelligence law of China to do whatever the Chinese government tells them in terms of espionage, in terms of technology theft or ripping off intellectual property or subversion, for that matter, anything else. But for $500,000, they can essentially buy their way into this country, get permanent resident status, and be away, you know, in terms of operating against this country. It's great that it's been paused, but it's insane that it's even allowed, isn't it?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And there have been all kinds of reports on national security implications of that program, the investor visa program. But we also need to consider that we have not put a pause on foreign students. And I mean, there's a pause specifically on China right now because of the virus. But when foreign students, they're not impacted at all by the executive order. And the Chinese foreign students dominate that flow. And then they move into the OPT program, which allows them to stay for 3 years after graduation and work with their employers, getting tax incentives, optional practical training, where employers actually get a tax break for hiring a foreign student instead of an American student. It's an insane program. But, you know, Chinese dominate in that system. They've got a pipeline that's going to continue as soon as the ban on China itself is lifted.
And that's partly because they pay full freight, and so these academic institutions are anxious to have them, and they obviously serve the interests of the Chinese Communist Party, which, among other things, runs out of the embassy and consulates across this country something called the Chinese Students and Scholars Association, which is becoming increasingly aggressive, Rosemary Jenks, in sort of oppressing other students on these campuses and otherwise working, you know, as I say, the will of the CCP. Lastly, Rosemary, I did want to ask you quickly about the president marked the completion of the 200th mile of fence or wall, as he calls it, along the southern border. How important is that as a step and indicative of what he's likely to get done before the end of this year?
It's very important. I mean, we all know that having a secure border is critical to the sovereignty of our nation. There's no question about that. It's critical to protect Border Patrol agents, you know, from when they're trying to stop the flow of drugs and humans and whatever else is coming across. They need to be able to funnel people around those walls so that they can apprehend them. So it's all absolutely critical. It is. I'm actually amazed that the federal government has successfully built 200 miles of this because, I mean, we all know what happens with government contracts. They tend to be very slow and very expensive.
Well, to say nothing of the resistance to the enterprise in the first instance, of course, that the Democrats have interposed. So just very quickly, much more of that to come in the remainder of this year?
I assume so. I mean, I think they're moving full steam ahead to get as much built as possible.
Yeah, I do too. Hopefully they will. Rosemary, hopefully you will come back to us again soon with updates. You are always welcome here, and we appreciate, again, so much what you do at numbersusa.com. Check it out, folks. Be well, my friend. Come back to us again soon. I hope the rest of you will come back to us again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.